I want to welcome you to the Retro Rogues Live podcast. This is a segment from last week's live video show. The live show is available every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on Twitch, YouTube, and Twitter. Simply search for BassGod14. That's BASSGOD14 on either YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter. And now, on with the show. On this episode, the Rogues, Eric Alexander, who is the Chief Financial Officer of Bad Bob Productions, and Dave Beatty, a professional comic book artist whose credits include such titles as Batman Incorporated, Justice League of America, and Grifter, were joined by special guest Dr. Hugo Strange. Dr. Strange is head of psychiatry at Arkham Asylum.
Thank Dr. Hugo Strange for being here on the show. This is part one of our Joker Actors Retrospective. We're going to talk about the actors who've actually helped bring the Joker to life. The character of the Joker actually, uniquely enough, actually now has two Oscar wins to the character's credit, which is very interesting. Of course, Joaquin Phoenix recently won the Oscar for his portrayal of the Joker. So we're going to talk about the Joker in sort of a deep dive retrospective, primarily focusing on the actors, but we're going to start off in a very unusual place. So Eric, if you don't mind sharing my screen. So we're going to start off, we're going to talk about sort of the inspiration for the Joker, at least the fictional Joker anyway. Dr. Strange is going to be available here to chime in on the actual real Joker for us, wherever we kind of go astray. So I've got a couple things here I want to get into talking about The Man Who Laughs. It's a very interesting film. And while many of the Batman's rogues gallery owe a thank you to Chester Gould's Dick Tracy and the comic strip Lawman's parade of odd and grotesque foes, the Joker actually predates them all in his first printed appearance, and his birth comes from a truly dark and disturbing vision of German Expressionism. The Man Who Laughs, a film from 1927, was from Universal Pictures and was based on the Victor Hugo novel, The Laughing Man. The novel actually opens in 1690 and actually follows a character by the name of Gwynplaine. Gwynplaine is heir to a British lordship and is abducted by his father's enemies and surgically disfigured by a band of gypsies. Over time, and after being abandoned, he finds a family with a carnival showman, a sort of family with a carnival showman, and Dee, a young abandoned girl that he actually finds in the snow. The film is actually by Paul Lenny, is intended as a follow-up of sense to the Universal successful other series of horror films of the time, films such as The Hunchback of Notre Dame and actually The Phantom of the Opera. At one time, the lead was actually going to be none other than horror icon Lon Chaney. Wow. Now, Conrad Veidt actually portrayed The Man Who Laughs, or Gwynplaine, and had previously starred in the silent era classic film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Might be pronouncing it wrong. The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is actually considered the first horror film. The sets and art direction are actually by Charles D. Hall, who would later also provide a similar aesthetic for both Frankenstein and Dracula. The Man Who Laughs had trouble upon its release due to its sexual boldness and choices made by the director, and it was attacked by a lot of censorship groups back in the day. Paul Lenny had hoped to actually do Dracula with Conrad Veidt, but it was not meant to be. This film and its visual style inspired both Bob Kane and Bill Finger to create the Joker. The influence is immediately visible. While the character does differ, since he is a tragic figure, it is interesting how the tragic nature of this character comes back directly and indirectly, and actually leads not only to one, but two Oscar wins, I personally feel, in my opinion, for the later actors who would portray the Joker.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Now, it's interesting, too, I got just a few more notes here. The film not only inspires the creation of the clown prince of crime, but also helps actually birth the horror genre as a whole, the horror film genre as a whole. And I just want to mention, there is an updated version of The Man Who Laughs that actually stars Gerard Depardieu. It looks like a piece of trash. I wouldn't bother watching it. And that has nothing to do with this silent era treasure, the original, the true Man Who Laughs. So I found this really interesting, the parallels. Actor delving into The Man Who Laughs and seeing the interesting connections, because, you know, Tim Burton's take on Batman and the Joker in the 89 movie is so very, seems kind of slightly off center and works so incredibly well. But when you go back and you look at The Man Who Laughs and you look at the art direction, you look at the cinematography, you look at what they do in terms of how they're playing with, you know, light and shadow, and the portrayal, obviously, of our tragic hero here, our tragic aunt. You know, you're going to have to watch the film, make your own conclusions on this character. But the character of Gwynplaine, it's interesting because I feel like the whole reason the bullet gets deflected in 89 and actually disfigures the Joker in the way and freezes his face is actually a nod to The Man Who Laughs. Stylistically, in terms of the contributions that Tim Burton brought to this, when you consider that Charles D. Hull, who was the art director for The Man Who Laughs, actually worked on Dracula and also worked on Frankenstein. You know, you can see the parallels. So this is a very interesting film. I would encourage our viewers, our listeners right now, to actually look into checking out and learning more about The Man Who Laughs if you're curious about the Joker. We're not going to get into the whole Jerry Robinson who drew the Joker playing card thing. We'll save that maybe for another episode. But it's very, very interesting the importance that The Man Who Laughs actually plays, obviously, in the creation of the Joker. But its influence looms large. It looms large, not only in what happens in the 89 film, but the role that this plays in informing, I feel like, not only some of what Heath Ledger does, but also some of what Joaquin Phoenix does later in his Oscar-winning turn as the Joker. It's very, very interesting. So tell me, we'll start off with our guest here, to start. So tell me, Dr. Strange, have you ever heard about the film The Man Who Laughs?
I've heard about it, but I've yet to see it.
How do you feel like The Man Who Laughed, kind of this film, how do you feel like this connects to actually the real Joker, the one who was once your patient at Arkham Asylum?
Well, he does have that look of horror upon him, and he is, looks like he's always laughing and smiling. And yeah, that's pretty much all I have on this, because again, I have yet to see the film. But from what you talked about, he was an anti-hero. Joker is very much not an anti-hero. He is a sadistic son of a bitch.
Interesting. So tell me, Eric, had you heard about The Man Who Laughs? Like, how much did you actually know? Had you heard about this film?
The reason this actually came to my attention was because of a blog. And I wish I could name the blog, because he's actually good to our show. He retweets our stuff and things like that on Twitter. And I can't remember the name of his blog. I know the person who does his name is Dave, but he does a very good history of comics blog. And he did something about the Joker when the Joaquin Phoenix Joker film came out, which is really what's inspired this episode. This episode is a tribute to Joaquin Phoenix and all the awards that he won, because he basically did a clean sweep of all the major awards, not just the Oscars, but Golden Globes, the SAG Awards, and also the British equivalent of the Oscars. He won all of them for this role of the Joker. But it all starts here. It really all starts here. As the origin of the Joker visually in the comics, I mean, just look at this. I mean,
yeah,
it's incredibly obvious, you know? but also the effect it's had on the films and me not realizing, because I remember people actually kind of debating in the Tim Burton Batman film about the whole thing of the Joker's being Nicholson's Joker being deformed. And right. Some people didn't like that because they're like, well, that's not in the comics. You know what I mean? And it's kind of funny because when you talk about sort of these nerd arguments or whatever, a lot of us didn't realize. I didn't realize because I was a kid when that came out. I didn't realize. Well, if you were a real nerd, you would know actually the original Joker was deformed. You know what I mean?
Right.
You would have gone right back to them. The Man Who Laughs. That's where that came from. And then, of course, Heath Ledger's Joker also has the deformity. And that's the reason that he has the small, like, the, you know, he's got the cuts. It's a yeah. different style of deformity, but he's deformed. And then what's really interesting to me is bringing it all full circle now with Joaquin Phoenix portrayal. And me, I'm the one who was saying, like, you know, the one thing I don't like about the Joker is, you know, to me, the Joker is not an anti-hero. He's a villain. That's who the Joker is. That's my version of the Joker, you know, the Joker that speaks to me. But I'm wrong, right? Because the real origins of the Joker, we're talking about the real origins of the Joker with the Man Who Laughs. He is a tragic anti-hero, you know? So it's really interesting when you think about that, you know, and that's basically, we're full circle now with the Joker. He's right back to where he started.
It's interesting and there's sort of like a tragic love story angle as well. It's just interesting. It's just very interesting for those of us that are curious about the character, the Joker, and I'd always heard, you know, in all the biographies I've read and a lot of the information, they always connect it back to the Man Who Laughs when they talk about, you know, the inspiration and the origins for the Joker. And I just found it just so interesting to see how not just the actors themselves, but how the filmmakers and the directors have managed a way to pay homage to the Man Who Laughs without really going out of their way to call attention to itself. It's like, yeah, if you're just familiar with the Man Who Laughs.
Because I think most people don't catch on to it because this is a very old movie and most people haven't seen it or even heard of it. I couldn't find it. You know what I mean? I was trying to find it so I could watch it for this program and I couldn't find it. Where did you end up watching it, Dave?
I used my dark arts and found a way to watch it through YouTube.
There you go.
Which I don't encourage people to do, but it's just really interesting to see all the connections. When you look at the craft and the skill, again, not just by the actors, but also by the filmmakers. That was my big revelation is how they all worked together to bring these, you know, homages to the Man Who Laughs, you know, to bring those to the forefront. Because it's just really interesting. So if you're curious about the Joker, if you want to go back and see the, you know, a lot of the original inspiration, the Man Who Laughs from 1928, this is going to be your starting point. But also too, I was surprised at how this film was intended to be a follow-up because of Universal's success with The Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Phantom of the Opera. And when you dig into this story, this Victor Hugo story that adapted for the film, it's readily apparent why they thought that, oh, well, this would be a good follow-up. This would be a great follow-up. It's very interesting. It's connections to the birth of the horror film genre. It's truly interesting. And I recommend people try and find a way to seek it out. You can also just watch some terribly interesting videos about it on YouTube. And the connection, you know, visually, when you talk about the connections to Frankenstein, the connections to Dracula, it's just terribly interesting. I was really kind of shocked at the role that this film has kind of subtly played. And as Eric said, how it kind of brings it all back in a sense, you know, with Joaquin Phoenix and and the new Joker film. It's really interesting. Big kudos and shout out to the directors, people like Tim Burton and Todd Phillips, who managed to also find a way, even from their standpoint, to call back to this classic silent era film. And it's interesting too, because this film fell right in that pocket, and they had the choice to actually have it be a silent film or to actually have it be a talkie. And the whole reason that they decided to just make it a silent film is because Conrad Veidt, you can't see it, he's actually got these wire things actually pulling his face back into this grin. And it made it hard for him to talk. So they decided, well, we'll just go ahead and make it a silent film because he's having a hard time talking anyway. And the gentleman who did the makeup actually for this is the same gentleman who did the makeup for Frankenstein. Wow. It's crazy the influence, the subtle influence that this film actually plays. It's very interesting. It was very interesting. I really enjoyed doing the research into this film and seeing all the connections that are there. And some of the connections I didn't know that actually connect back to just film in general. It's very interesting. So that's where our conversation starts. Does anyone else have anything interesting to add about The Man Who Laughs?
Well, I wonder what the right situation is with that film and why it's so hard to find. I would be interested to figure that out. I'm going to have to do some research and find out what the issue is with the rights of that film and why it seems so inaccessible right now.
I have no idea. I didn't even look into it from that standpoint. It is, it's just one of those things. I don't know if someone's sitting on it for a reason, maybe it's locked up in someone's library. There may be a movie studio that controls the rights that doesn't think that it's worth bothering to digitize it to make it available in a better format. It is a little strange to watch because all silent films, the acting is with the eyes and the body language. Mm-hmm. So, positions are a little bit more distorted. But it was interesting because, again, watching the distortions that Conrad Veidt was doing, it harkened back to Joaquin Phoenix's dancing, after he kills the guys on the subway. And I was just like, wow, this is just so – and whether they just came up with that on the set and someone suggested it or not, it's very interesting that if it wasn't deliberate and it was in the moment, how in a weird way it harkens back to – the contortions and the things that Conrad Veidt was doing to help bring this character's torment to life. And I kept thinking, it's interesting how, even if it's not directly, inspired by that, how it harkens back. It's just,
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
If they were smart, they would have released that at the same time as the Joker movie.
Yeah.
DVD.
That would have been really cool. Or have like a special collector's edition. You know what I mean? Where you get the two films like they did with Scarface. I have that, the Scarface where it comes with the original Scarface. And that's also really cool to watch how much they took from the original Scarface for the Al Pacino version. But yeah, that would be so cool if they did that with the Joker. They did something like that.
That would have been.
Yeah, that would have been great.
Like a crazy Mondo poster or something like that with it too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. So are we good here with The Man Who Laughs?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, cool. So real quick here, just before we switch over, I want to remind everyone, thank everyone for participating in the comments. Please remember, if you comment on the show, you're entered into a drawing to possibly win another sketch card. Again, this one is for the Joker. This is a Batman the Legend sketch card. This is an official Cryptozoic release. You can tell by the little hollow foil on the back. The artwork here is by me. You're being entered into this. Again, shipping in the United States only, please. And let's have everyone be at least 18 years of age. All right. So, we got a comment from Orville Nation. Big support of the show. That's awfully kind. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, PJ. We appreciate it. We appreciate all your support, the support of Orville Nation to the show. They're great That's friends awesome. Of the show. Orville Nation is fantastic. PJ is fantastic as a leader in the sort of streaming community. He's all about helping out shows and things like that. PJ, you're awesome. And I had a great time being on his channel. And I think Dave, you're going to be on there fairly soon. So,
yeah, should be a lot of fun. Hopefully, we'll be talking about Orville here coming up because I'm ready to get back into some fun Star Trek kind of stuff feel like Star Trek stuff.
So. Well, PJ's been talking a lot about Picard. Actually, I mean that's why I was on his show. I was talking about Picard, so they talk about Picard a lot. And I also know that he's trying to get some stuff with Space Command. I don't know if you've heard of Space Command. His name doesn't pop into my head right away. He wrote for Deep Space Nine and other Star Trek and stuff like that. He has his own show called Space Command, and now it's going to be a web series. So PJ's always on top of it. He's always finding these neat, cool sci-fi things and stuff like that. And he gets some great guests. You know, he had Corin Nemec, you know, from Stargate, and Parker Lewis can't lose. And I really recommend that interview because Corin Nemec is really good as far as engaging as a guest. Because quite frankly, sometimes you see some people, celebrities, on trying to do like a YouTube thing, and they're not very good. They're really not. You know what I mean? They're not that engaging. And Corin Nemec was really good. And he's had some other actors, like he had the actor that played Icheb. From Star Trek Voyager, he had him on. He's had Martok, the actor played Martok. So some great content on Orville Nation.
So tell us.
There's the name, Mark.
Zekri.
He's a writer, and he has a series now called Space Command that he's been working on for a long time. So
tell us, Dr. Strange, are you familiar with the TV show The Orville?
I've heard of it. I've seen snippets of it. It seemed like it was probably better than Picard from what I've seen.
Interesting.
Or at least from what you've told me about Picard.
Yeah. We know that you're awfully busy, you know, treating the patients at Arkham Asylum and, you know, trying to help, reform the patients there and hopefully in your work help keep, you know, the citizens of Gotham City safe. You know, so I understand you don't have a lot of time for sci-fi shows and as such. So I was just curious if you were familiar with it. That's all.
I am. I know Seth MacFarlane is the one that created it.
Yep, that's true. So is that good? Are we ready to move on to?
Dave, PJ gave you a good plug or something, a good opportunity to plug because he says he wants to interview about your comics. Which I'm sure he's talking about Red Skirts. He wants to know more about Red Skirts, and I think he would like to do a program where he talks to you about Red Skirts.
No, yeah, I would love to talk about Red Skirts. I'd be happy to talk about any of the various comics I've worked on. That would be a lot of fun. So yeah, for sure. After actually watching so much of the Orville, I'd love to work actually on an Orville comic. I think that would be really fun. I quite enjoy the show, and I think it'll be a lot of fun to work on that. They've got a good crew actually doing the Orville comic series already, though, so I don't know what the chances of that are, but it would be fun to work on. So that's for sure. So I think that'd be fun.
Then there'd be something fun for us to review in the future, too, is the Orville.
No, comic. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely. So if we're good with The Man Who Laughs, are we ready to move on to our next Joker?
Absolutely. He's one of the best, as far as I'm concerned.
I apologize, but I seem distracted. I am. I do have two therapy cats in here from Selena.
Oh, okay. All right, that makes sense. Our next Joker we're going to talk about is. I don't see how you get more classic than this particular portrayal of the Joker. I did kind of put together some notes here. So it's interesting to note that the murderous Joker undergoes many changes after his debut in Batman number one from 1940, none more noteworthy then after the instatement of the Comics Code Authority in the wake of Wortham's 1954 book, The Seduction of the Innocent. The Senate trials and the witch hunt to follow have forever changed and the influence of comics on American culture, and the impact was also felt on characters such as the Joker. The evil murderous Joker was transformed into what legendary Batman editor Daniel O'Neill said at the time, and he would often refer to as just a wacky, ribald nuisance. And that leads us actually to Cesar Romero's portrayal of the Joker in the 1966 Batman television series. You know, Caesar's Joker is very much definitive for a classic take on the post-comics code crackdown. Romero knew nothing about the Joker based on interviews and was offered the role by Batman 66 producer William Dozier. He took the role after seeing the pilot episode that actually starred Frank Gorshin as the Riddler and reading a script that he received for his first episode. Now, probably the most commonly known thing about Romero's Joker is the white grease paint makeup that they would actually apply over his mustache. Romero considered his mustache his signature look, and he refused to shave off the mustache for this role. You know, not much is known about how Caesar felt about the later portrayals of the Joker, but on a CBS This Morning interview from 1989 that I found, he was dismayed by the fact that a lot of the reviewers had told parents not to take their children to see the Tim Burton film, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Wow.
And in that interview, he still had his trademark mustache. I mean, he very much considered it, you know, that was his look. And Romero one time was a highly sought after actor and a bit of a Latin heartthrob back in the day. So there's some interesting information about this particular portrayal of the Joker. I do like Cesar Romero's take on the Joker. There is an interesting nod, actually, to Cesar Romero's Joker that we'll talk about in our part two and how that actually connects up with another actor's portrayal of the Joker. But tell me, Erica, give me some of your thoughts on Cesar Romero's Joker from the 1966 Batman television series.
Well, I think in this era, he's highly underrated. I mean, this is the first Joker that I grew up with, because I wasn't even, you know, I've talked to you before. I didn't really read superhero comics. I read G.I. Joe and Transformer comics as a kid. The way that I got access to superheroes was through the cartoons, or in this case, we actually had a live action version that I had access to as a child, you know? And so this is like my first Joker, you know, this is the Joker to me, you know what I mean? Or at least it was until actually one of our later incarnations we're actually going to talk about in part two, who I think is the definitive Joker. He's my pick for the definitive Joker. But this is the first one I was exposed to. This is the first Joker I was exposed to. And I think his portrayal actually still holds up. I think even if you're not a big fan of the Adam West Batman series, I think this portrayal of the Joker still holds up and still has a place, you know what I mean, in terms of the Joker. Because I do think that sort of whimsical, you know, kind of like just kind of like silly, you know, like a clown, you know what I mean? I mean, he really is like a clown. I really like this portrayal of the Joker. And even when I think other aspects of the Adam West Batman series haven't aged that well, I think this one has. I think he's highly underrated in today's culture.
Well, and it's always sometimes easy to dismiss the first. And while we nod to the inspiration of Conrad Veidt in The Man Who Laughs, obviously Cesar Romero's Joker, this is our first live action Joker. This is where it all starts.
Right.
And obviously there are things that Cesar Romero did that carry over into every iteration of the Joker. So he does originate, you know, the Joker in live action. And it's always easy to be dismissive of who comes first. You see that all the time. But this is definitely the classic, in my mind, probably the most definitive interpretation of the post, you know, crackdown, comics code crackdown of the Joker. It's classic in every sense of the word. This version lasts so long and its influence is so, so long reading after the 66 television series, that if you listen to a Power Records Batman adventure, this is the version of the Joker that's on that. Even though Romero doesn't voice it, the guy doing Joker, he's doing Cesar Romero. when you watch, you know, the Joker and Scooby-Doo, you're getting someone's version of Cesar Romero's Joker. And, you know, superpowers, you name it. Like, this version of the Joker is that definitive version that lasts the longest, in my personal opinion. So tell us, Dr. Strange, how does Cesar Romero's interpretation of the Joker for the 1966 television series, how does this relate or reflect to the actual real Joker, who, again, was once your patient at Arkham Asylum?
That was a time of his life where my treatments were actually working. We'll call him Happy Joker.
Ah, Happy Joker.
All right. It's more like a high school bully, if that makes any sense. He was always just out there. It's like, oh, I'm going to get you, Batman. I'm going to, you know, give you a super wedgie from like this giant crane of whatever joke he had up his sleeve. I mean, it was all about the punchline, all about the jokes. It was before he became murderous again.
Interesting.
Theatrics. Also a lot of theatrics.
This is the Joker taking his meds, right? Is that what I'm getting? This is the version of the Joker when he was actually taking his medication.
This is the Joker medicated.
Yes. That makes a lot of sense to me. I will say also, in regards to Joaquin Phoenix's portrayal of the Joker, visually, I think Joaquin Phoenix Joker is based on Cesar Romero in terms of his clothes and the makeup and everything. I think the Joaquin's version of the Joker is absolutely visually an homage to the Cesar Romero Joker.
Yeah, I could see that. I could definitely see that.
I can see that.
It's interesting because I think of the 89 one being closer, but the 89 version of the Joker is actually a bit of a departure from this.
Yes.
And until you look at them kind of side by side, you don't realize in terms of color palette and choices how they did make a conscious choice to move in a slightly different direction. It's still the Joker when you see it, but visually they did make some different choices that deviated from the classic interpretation of the character. And I do think that Joaquin's is much more in line. That's an interesting observation.
Yeah, it was one of the first things people I saw saying was when they first saw Joaquin Phoenix, when the first pictures were shown, you know, I remember when those came out and people, hey, that's the Cesar Romero look. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Interesting. So are we good here with the 66 interpretation of the Joker?
Yes. And if anybody hasn't checked that one out, you check that out. Oh, we do have some other ones to mention before we get to this one, though.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I am jumping ahead.
Because we were talking before. These are hard to find because these guys, unfortunately, didn't get a lot of attention. So let's go ahead and be the people that do give them some attention, because these are like the forgotten Jokers. We're going to go through like the forgotten Jokers from the animated Jokers. That's not the right one. Make sure I can have the. I have a little bit of a technical issue here. Give me one second. I'm going to.
Okay.
So, because what we're going to do is we're going to talk about some of these, the first animated Jokers, the first voice actors that actually did the Joker character.
So I've got a bit of a lull here. I want to remind everyone, hopefully everyone who's watching, if you come into the comment section and you comment here on this episode, you'll be entered into a drawing to possibly win this Joker sketch card. This Joker sketch card is actually from Batman the Legend set. This is actually an officially released set by Cryptozoic Entertainment, and obviously in partnership there with DC Comics. This is a hand-drawn original sketch on this card. The art is by me. It is our featured character, our main topic of this show, which is actually the Joker. This is sort of a classic interpretation of the Joker, probably more in line with the Cesar Romero version, actually, we were just speaking of. This is a one of one. I want to encourage everyone, please come into the All you have to do to be entered into this is just come into the live, leave us a couple comments or leave a comment or two. Please join the discussion talking about the Joker, and you'll be entered again. U.S. Shipping only, and please be at least at or above the age of 18 years of age. Okay.
All right. So this is these are the, like I said, I would call them sort of the forgotten Jokers. And there's actually a few of them. So what we've got here is.
Oh, Larry Storch.
From 1968, this was Batman with Robin, the Boy Wonder, the cartoon. And we've got Larry Storch here. He also did him in the new Scooby-Doo movies in 1972. Yep. And you can see the kind of the looks of the Joker and those different iterations.
Yeah.
I believe I did see the new Scooby-Doo movies, but I don't think I ever saw Batman with Robin, the Boy Wonder. Did you ever see that, Dave?
Oh, not only have I seen it, I actually have the DVD release that came out many, many years ago.
Okay, cool.
Obviously I'm a rabid Batman collector, so I have those actually on a DVD. And then once upon a time, I actually had them on VHS too. They had a line where they took a lot of the, because the Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder was produced around the same time as the Aquaman, the older Aquaman cartoons, if you're familiar with those, where they had the, it was Aquaman and Aqualad, and they rode around on seahorses, and they had the walrus that was sort of like the silly sidekick. But then I also had the Superman and the Superboy cartoons. Those are all produced, those all early Filmation productions. They are so comics accurate. It is crazy. And they're wonderful if you love the original classic comic stories. They don't flinch from anything, whether it makes sense or not. They just go for it. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, all of those. And actually, and I think it was either the late, I think it was the early 90s or late 80s, they actually released those on VHS, and they're all part of a Superpowers animated collection.
Oh, cool.
And it actually didn't connect back to the actual versions of the cartoons that accompanied the toy line, but it was all these classic Filmation versions, very interesting stuff. I love those old cartoons. So,
Doctor Strange, are you familiar with either of these versions of the Joker from the Batman and Robin, the Boy Wonder, or from the new Scooby-Doo movies?
Not particularly, but I am familiar with the cartoons he was referencing. With Aquaman and everyone. I do remember when I was younger watching the cartoons with the Joker and everything, but I can't remember because it was so long ago. Now, the really weird, wonky flash vibrating through walls, now that I remember because... What has been seen cannot be unseen.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I ever saw the Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder one. I do think I saw the Scooby-Doos, but I was really, really young when I saw those. So then we go up to 1977, and we have the New Adventures of Batman. And that was... Lenny, I don't know if I can pronounce his last name, Lenny Wienrib. And I don't know if I watched this one. I don't know if I ever saw the New Adventures of Batman. Did you, Dave?
Yes, this is actually one of my favorite, Batman cartoons. Is actually the Filmation version. They actually kind of reused this title many years later for actually a version of, I guess they call it the New Adventures. The New Adventures of Batman is probably, for me, the Batman show that was the most formative, along with the 66 Batman TV show. But I loved this particular version. It's so Filmation, though. It's just, if you're familiar with Filmation and cartoons, this is the one that actually has Batmite in it. If anyone remembers the animated Batmite, he actually comes into play actually with the new adventures of Batman. All right. So while we're talking about this, let's do this here real quick. But if you'll share my screen, for those people not familiar, this is the intro for the New Adventures of Batman, which was the show for the 1970s. I love this version. This actually has Adam West and Burt Ward doing the voices. They're of course, the infamous Batmite. And the animation in this intro is actually really cool. All the classic Bat vehicles are represented. There's, of course, the Joker, who we're primarily featuring. Very unusual.
That Catwoman looks almost exactly like, I'm having a brain fart, but you know, from Christopher Nolan's Batman movie series. What's the actress's name?
Anne Hathaway.
Yeah, Anne Hathaway. That looked exactly like Anne Hathaway.
So that's the intro there for the New Adventures of Batman. Like I said, besides the 60s, and Dr. Hugo Strange there.
There we go. So you're familiar with this one.
Yes, I'm familiar with that one. And to show you the Filmation cartoons, there's this collection that's out there.
Oh, nice.
It was pretty wild seeing Hawkman with a blaster on his hand.
Do you use any of these cartoons to aid in your treatment of the patients at Arkham Asylum, Dr. Strange?
Yes, I do. And they still, to this day, make them all highly underestimate Aquaman.
I could see that. And then we have a comment here. I did mention that earlier. Yes, Adam West was the voice of Batman in the New Adventures of Batman, and Burt Ward was the voice of Robin. I talked earlier about the influence of, you know, Cesar Romero's Joker. Of course, Adam West and Burt Ward's legacy as the characters also loom large and inform a lot of later productions of the characters. It's so, for someone like me, who grew up with the 60s TV series and then segued into the New Adventures of Batman, these classic portrayals of the characters, I mean, you don't, in my mind anyway, when you come to Batman, you don't get any more definitive, because Romero's Joker, again, as well as these versions of Batman and Robin, they're the same versions. Like if you listen to the Power Records stories, if you listen to any of the Peter Pan back in the day, they had you turn the page, you know, and you follow along with the story. That is the classic versions. And of course, Adam West would come back later and provide the voice for Batman, even on the Superpowers later cartoon shows as well. Batmite. Again, some people love him and some people hate him.
Man of Sand said, I remember the character of Batmite, and he said he had a love crush on Batgirl. Do you remember that aspect of it?
Yeah, well, they showed it in the intro. Actually, Batgirl is featured pretty heavily in the intro. She comes in on her motorcycle, again, very much homaging the 60s television series. Because, again, that was the most successful version of Batman. And, again, that influence looms large.
Yeah, he also says that he really liked the theme, the action music in that show. He's a fan of the music.
It's a very classic Filmation. This series is, for me, it's one of the most important of the Batman versions of Batman in animation for me. When I think of Batman, I think of the classic version. You know, I think of the way that, you know, although Neil Adams ushered in this particular portrayal of the character as we think of it, I think of Jim Aparo and I think of the style of the New Adventures of Batman.
Very cool.
So, no, yeah, for sure, for sure.
And then we have another of the, what I kind of call the forgotten Jokers. This one I do remember better because I was a fan of the Superpowers team, Galactic Guardians. Yeah. So I used to watch that as a kid. So one of the things I remember was a lot of those shows was how absent the Joker was from, from the, you know, the Super Friends and things like that, that it was very, you know, we only got him, I think, the one time, you know, in that whole line. And Super Friends is really what got me into superheroes. In fact, the reason I consider myself a DC guy is in large part because of Super Friends. You know, that's what really got me into it and made me love those characters so much. So as I said, these guys, I don't think get a whole lot of attention, but we're going to give them some attention here.
And I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Man of Sam.
Yeah, Man of Sam.
Man of Sam. His last comment there, that is very true. Frank Welker, a.k.a. Fred from Scooby-Doo. And also, for those of you who don't know, that is Megatron from Transformers.
Isn't that cool? That's pretty cool.
Legendary voice actor. Legendary.
I don't think many people know that he portrayed the Joker. I don't think many people know that, you know?
I had no idea either.
No, yeah. You know, it used to be that you had those great character actors who could do all those different voices. And they would, if you are familiar enough with them enough, you could sometimes hear them when they do different versions, you know, different kinds of characters. But sometimes they're so good at being a chameleon that you don't even know. Frank Welker is a legendary voice actor and done tons and tons of stuff.
The Band of Sands also is a Super Friends fan. He said Super Friends was a big breakthrough show, and I agree. And he said it's because it had an ensemble, and that's exactly right. In fact, Dave, you and I have this discussion quite a bit, where I always talk about growing up with things like, you know, the Superman live action movie with Christopher Reeves, even like the Batman film with Nicholson and Michael Keaton and things like that. As a kid, I was like, where the hell is Superman? Or where the hell is Batman in the Superman movie? Why isn't Superman in the Batman movie? You know what I mean? Because I didn't really understand rights or anything like that. And I was like, hey, why is there only one superhero? Because I knew they knew each other. You know, I knew that they knew each other and they went on adventures together. So as a kid, I was always like wondering, where is everybody? And I think I got that from Super Friends. Because Super Friends, it did have everybody. You know, and I was just
Well, and Challenge of the Super Friends is probably still in my mind, you know, until you get, you know, obviously, you know, the Batman animated series, the Superman animated cartoons, the later Justice League cartoons, there's been some really wonderful stuff that's been done since that time. But for the longest time, Challenge of the Super Friends was the standard. You know, for those of us that were diehard comic fans, but who also enjoyed animation, because you got a lot of the classic hero and villain rivalries, and the introduction of characters that typically you wouldn't get, such as Green Lantern, and the fact that you even got Sinestro, you know, so you had Green Lantern as greatest arch enemy. One of the strangest things about Super Friends was the fact that for Batman, you know, the arch enemy was like, you know, Catwoman or Scarecrow or, you know what I mean? It wasn't Joker. Joker didn't have a very huge role to play, it seems like, in all those cartoons, and I'm not honestly sure why. I'm sure there's got to be a reason for it, but I'm not honestly sure why. Of course, Madison also points out that the voice announcer and narrator for Super Friends, he wants to know who was it. Was it Ted Knight? I honestly don't remember. I know because it was the same guy who did the intros, I think, for Saturday Night Live.
It was Bill Woodson. Bill Woodson.
Oh, okay.
I saw the question and I went and looked it up. It was Bill Woodson. He was the narrator for Challenge of the Super Friends. And he was not credited. That's why apparently he's hard to find. The article I found said he was not credited.
Yeah, the classic, meanwhile, in the halls of justice.
Exactly.
Which I love. I love that. Which, I mean, to me is a callback to the 60s Batman TV show again. Meanwhile, in his unassuming bookstore, the bookworm is up to no good. You know, it's all, you know what I mean? It's just the influence of the 60s Batman show is huge.
So. Yeah, and he also mentions that Super Friends gave DC a big boost versus Marvel because they didn't have a similar Avengers show at the time. And I agree with that. I think it's also kind of why they made the Spider-Man series, Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, was kind of meant to compete with Super Friends. And that's actually the Spider-Man, that was my first Spider-Man, was Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, which I love that. I love that cartoon. But again, that's why I consider myself a DC guy, is because of Super Friends and because Marvel didn't have anything equivalent to that, that I was watching, that I was aware of, you know? So
no, yeah.
I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Is the Doctor familiar with that version of the Joker?
Are you familiar with that version, Doctor Strange?
Oh, Super Friends? Yes, I am. That's all the right. One that had Cyborg and Firestorm, am I correct?
Right.
Yes, where it is.
That was like the last season. Cyborg was introduced in the last season. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the one where Batman cried. I remember that now.
Yes, that's the episode where Batman cried. You are correct. I want to thank Man of Stan for commenting. I'll plug it one last time. Anyone who joins in and comments actually during the show is entered into a drawing to possibly win this Joker sketch card. Again, all the names are just thrown into a hat, and I pull one out, and that's who wins. This is an original one-of-a-kind sketch card. This was from the Cryptozoic and DC Comics set, Batman Man of Legend. This is a one-of-one. You can tell it's official. It's got the little hollow foil there on the cover on the corner. So I want to thank and encourage anyone else who's watching the show who hasn't commented yet, get in and make that comment and get entered into the contest.
And speaking of comments, Man of Sin has a couple more that are interesting to me because I didn't know this. He said that there was also a 60s Wonder Woman show, too, of a similar campy style. I'm not familiar with that one.
I've seen some of that. I think it was an unaired pilot. Because I've seen it like once.
He says, though, it may have been short-lived and less known.
Yeah.
And then also, we had Orville Nation here earlier, and he says Seth MacFarlane did a great homage to Super Friends on Family Guy. I don't think I've seen that episode. Have you?
No, I don't think I have.
But I would like to. I would like to see Seth MacFarlane's take on the Super Friends. That'd be kind of fun. I think that'd be kind of fun.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in the Griffin household. Yeah. Stewie is contemplating yet another way to take over the world. Yeah. So very cool. Was that it for the Forgotten Jokers? Did you have?
Let me just double check because I don't want to be like everybody else and forget to talk about these people. You know what I mean? So
right.
I think
I'm trying to remember because I know one of them actually came back and did the voice for. If I remember correctly, actually did the voice for the Joker in the Batman animated series. I think it's the Legends of the Dark Knight episode where they showed different iterations and versions of Batman over time. So they had a segment that was like the Dick Sprang Golden Age inspired look. And then they had a Frank Miller Dark Knight Returns style. And then, yeah, then eventually they had, you know, the classic, you know, Batman animated version and actually homaged and talked about the different interpretations of Batman through the episode.
Do you remember what the name of that episode was?
I think it was Legends of the Dark Knight. I'm going to.
I remember that episode. Legends of the Dark Knight. Right. I'm actually looking it up. Of the Dark Knight Batman animated series, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm kind of curious when you bring that up.
At least I thought it was. I could be wrong. As we all start checking our
I'm having trouble finding them because you bringing it up just made me curious. I'm having trouble finding him or finding the cast for that episode.
Yeah, if you want to move on to the next one of the Forgotten Jokers, and then I will see if I can look that up.
We're actually all caught up until up to Nick Nicholson. So.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's go ahead and let's get into Nicholson here. And what we can do is we can clear this up and actually talk about it maybe on the next episode.
Right.
Because we'll be talking about another animated Joker on the next episode for sure.
Oh yeah, we're gonna. We were talking off air, and there's many more animated Jokers than I realized. There's a ton of them. And also, Manasseh had a question. I don't know if either of you know, but he was asking, has Filmation done any other superheroes besides Batman?
I think Doctor Strange, do you want to answer this question for our commenter, Manasseh? Has Filmation done any other superheroes, like superhero cartoons, besides Batman?
Aquaman, Superman, the Teen Titans, Green Lantern, Flash, Justice League, Hawkman, The Atom, and Plastic Man.
Wow. So Filmation did all those, huh? Wow.
Yeah, and Superboy as well, because they did Superman and
Superboy. Oh, yeah, Superboy. Forgot about him.
I think Plastic Man was the one I used to watch. I used to watch the Plastic Man cartoon.
Well, there was a Hanna-Barbera one too. So
okay, I think I watched the Hanna-Barbera one then.
Yeah,
the Hanna-Barbera one is Plastic the one Man. I loved Plastic Man growing up as a kid.
Filmation had the rights to the DC heroes, and they did just about anything that they could get their hands on. The gems, in my opinion, and I did mention that, Manasseh. Yes, there was the classic Plastic Man cartoon that people think of was Hanna-Barbera.
Okay, yeah. Got that one mixed up.
But I do want to point out that if you are a DC Comics fan, if you love the classic original stories, like the stuff from like the Silver Age in the 50s and the 60s, the Aquaman cartoons Filmation that was released out on DVD several years ago, it is totally worth the price of admission. The Superman, the Superboy stuff that Filmation did is really great. I love the New Adventures of Batman. That's one of my favorite Batman cartoons of all time. You have to be a fan of those classic stories, though. For certain members of the later generation, I don't see how they could watch that stuff and enjoy it anymore, to be honest. I think our society is just in a different place.
They want Adventure Time. They can enjoy good quality TV.
It's a good point, but I will bring this up because years ago I helped organize a convention, and actually the funds from the convention are actually being used to help send kids to actually a summer camp. It was done in the back room of a school, and they had an area where they could show audio visual stuff. And then we had I had brought a bunch of this stuff, and I had it playing. So it's kind of like whenever you go to a convention and you've got like the movie room, you know, that's showing movies like 24 hours a day. So I gave all these DVDs over, and all the kids were just mesmerized by like Super Friends and Aquaman and all these classic Filmation cartoons. A lot of the really good Filmation DC stuff is the stuff that they were doing in the 60s. I personally love the Aquaman cartoons. They're a lot of fun. They're kind of silly with the seahorse and the walrus and all that kind of thing. Filmation very much was a big believer in the comic relief sidekick kind of character. I mean,
oh yeah,
you know, when you Yeah, if you watch New Adventures of Batman, I mean, you see Orko and Batmite coming a mile away. You know, it's no wonder that, you know, that character eventually, you know, was there. No, I highly, highly recommend them. If you're not familiar with them, definitely seek them out. If you want to see the classic version of Brainiac animated, like, it's crazy. The stuff is, and they didn't shy away from anything.
Give that Fisherman, man some pants.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But no, they're great.
We got a few more chats here. I want to make sure we at least try to address these questions. So he also asked if did they ever do a Captain Marvel
animation? Well, they did. That is a great omission on both of our parts there, Dr. Strange. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, now, absolutely.
Now, Filmation not only did the live action version where they're in the Winnebago, the Saturday morning version, and that actually does have some animated sequences in it, but they did do that is another one of my favorites. I don't know why it has never been released on DVD. It absolutely drives me nuts. I'm still holding on to some old VHS copies. Let me see if I can pull that up real quick. The Filmation Captain Marvel stuff. DC
streaming app.
Yeah, exactly. They actually went through the trouble to restore the live action series. And the animated one, for some reason, is just being allowed to languish. And I don't understand why. It is literally a travesty. So let's see. Okay. All right. If you don't mind sharing my screen, we're going to give this a go. There might be an ad on the front end of it. I don't know. Yep. Shazam. This is the intro. This is a great Filmation animated series, especially if you love the classic C.C. Beck version of Captain Marvel. These pop-ups are so annoying. Just the classic style. I mean, this is Captain Marvel the way everyone remembers it. I actually have hanging above my desk here in my studio, actually a original animation cell from this from the Filmation Captain Marvel Shazam series.
Wow.
Yeah. I bought it at auction. Let's see. Would have been 30. Wow, is it that long ago? I'm getting so old. Over 30 years ago at auction. Paid a pretty penny for it. It actually has the original background painting too.
This actually looks pretty good.
This is like if you love Shazam, i.e. Captain Marvel, this is the cartoon for you. This cartoon is great. It's a lot of fun. It's the flying sequences, and I mean, it's just really great. It's really great. I love this. I don't understand why this has never been made available. It's just one of those things. I don't understand why this isn't on the DC app. Like, why didn't someone go in and restore this? I love the live action version, you know. But this is such a classic version of the character. I love it. So yeah. It may be possible to watch some of these episodes actually on YouTube. I just wish that Warner's would have went in and actually restored them, and you know, kind of brought them back. And I wonder again what the legal rights reason is why they can't or won't do it. There's some reason why.
Maybe they will for Shazam too.
That would be great. That would be great. But if you do love if you do love Captain Marvel, of course, Filmation, they also did the classic live action version, you know, with Mentor and the Winnebago and the whole thing. And you can actually watch those on the DC Universe app. They actually took the time to restore those. They actually went back to the original film and actually restored all those, and they look absolutely fantastic. So if you have the DC Universe app, it's totally worth checking out. It's definitely a nostalgia trip watching those for sure.
Now, back when we were talking about Legends of the Dark Knight, Bobby was asking if that was Mark Hamill, and no, Mark Hamill didn't play the Joker in that episode. So we'll figure it out. But no, Mark Hamill played the Joker in every other episode, but not that one.
Yeah,
not that specific one.
And that Joker's meant to go back to the classic golden age, like the Dick Sprang interpretation or version of the Joker. And that episode's a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
And then also, I think Man of Sand came in late, but
Man of Sand, we brought that up earlier in the show.
Yeah.
During the pop culture news segment. We talked about the entire cast of Masters of the Universe Revelation, the Kevin Smith produced series for Netflix. I am very, very excited and looking forward to that. I'm a big Masters of the Universe fan. I have been for years. I've tortured several people with my own interpretation pitch idea for Masters of the Universe, including Eric. Eric has unfortunately had to sit through that long-winded, crazy pitch.
I have some ideas about that,
Strange,
by the way.
So. I didn't realize you were such a Masters of the Universe fan.
Not so much a fan of the Master Universe, but I am a fan of Skeletor.
I don't think we can hear. Can everyone else hear Doctor Strange? I can't hear him.
I can hear him. I heard him say he's a fan of Skeletor.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Skeletor, but not so much as the He-Man, as you say.
And I do want to mention for anybody that was coming in late and didn't see before, Man of Sam asked, said Filmation's most famous hero may have been He-Man, which is going to be revived as a series on Netflix. We did talk about that in our news segment. And if anybody wants to maybe do a replay, once this is posted, they can go back.
Hold on.
Okay. Dave is having some technical issues. But if anybody wants to go back, you can actually, once this is posted, you can go back and watch the beginning of the episode, or you can wait, and usually within a day, within 24 hours, what I do on YouTube is I actually break up the show by topic. So you can always come back and maybe you can just, watch that segment that when we were talking about Master of the Universe. So if anybody who missed the first part of the show, you've got two options there. One is just to wait when this thing posts, which is usually just like a couple minutes after we're gone. And then you can go back and look at the beginning of the episode, or you can wait until I chop up the episode by topic and you can go see it that way.
Sorry about that, everyone. My headphones suddenly decided to stop working.
It happens. Technical difficulties.
I like these Bluetooth headphones, but I tell you, they keep doing this stuff and it's so annoying. I don't understand why I did that. They just went dead. Sorry about that.
It happens. Technical difficulties. It's technology. So.
Yeah.
Yes, I know that feeling all too well. My laptop was handed to me by Arkham, and this is why I'm using my phone.
Hey, Man of Sand has another interesting comment. He said, I noticed that Filmation's transformation scene for He-Man almost seems derived from Filmation's transformation scene from Shazam. That's some interesting insight there.
That's He-Man interesting. He-Man is very much a collection of like Filmation's greatest hits. I think that's part of why He-Man works so well. They were able to take all these different elements and different approaches that work so well in all the other cartoons and actually use them to help bring He-Man to life. So,
but that's an interesting observation, especially because I think I only saw that intro just now when you showed it. And yeah, I kind of agree with you, Man of Sand. That is there's something there, you know what I mean? So,
yeah. Are we ready to move on to our last Joker here?
Let's do it.
All right. Okay. Well, this is the big one for me. So let me get my notes back up because I did actually prepare something. So the dark reinvention of Batman in the 1970s and the wildly successful Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns in the 80s ushered in yet both a return to form and a new kind of evil for the Joker. This leads us to Jack Nicholson's performance as the Joker in Warner Brothers' 1989 classic, Batman. Nicholson was asked by the producers to actually be the Joker while he was actually filming Witches of Eastwick. The two most commonly known things concerning this version of the Joker in the 89 Batman film concern the nature of Jack's deal and his and it actually kind of overshadows his tremendous performance. So the first thing I always hear people bringing up constantly over and over again is basically his back-end deal. To make a long story short, because the producers could not pay him what he really wanted, they basically had to make a back-end deal for points. And this actually made him a fortune due to the success of the film. I think it's part of the reason that Jack doesn't shy away. Like if you have the 89 Batman Blu-ray, Jack Nicholson is on all the behind-the-scenes stuff, you know, talking about the Joker. He's got a little Batman 89 lapel pin on it, and he seems very proud of his work on the 89 film. I think it is probably most memorable, and for me personally, one of his best performances. But he's just very proud of it, and he likes to celebrate the fact that he was involved in this. And I think that's really cool, because a lot of times on the when you watch even later years, you watch these behind the scenes DVDs and stuff, oftentimes these actors of his caliber, they're not even on them. You know, for example, like Keaton is nowhere except in previous file footage. That's the only way that he's actually included in a lot of that behind the scenes stuff. But a lot of the stuff with Jack is new. And it's just really interesting to see that. But I think it's because of that back end deal. I mean, this is a very good payday for him. And that's one of the things that people, you know, constantly bring up, like on the street, like civilians. It's one of the things they constantly bring up. And the second one was that he famously told Michael Keaton when they were basically getting makeup and stuff applied before they went out to film, he said, "Just let the wardrobe do the acting, kid." Okay. So these are the things that civilians constantly bring up to me about the 89 movie in relation to Nicholson's performance. And these seem to be the things he's most remembered for besides his powerhouse performance. And I'm just going to tell everyone right now, I'm going to go on the record by saying I'm sick of hearing about him personally. I get it. I would rather talk about the importance of his performance, because it is this one that begins to run back to the source material and even The Man Who Laughs. And it's eerily dark and tortured view of the world. And while having fun and chewing the scenery with his performance, without Nicholson, we would never get the radical reinvention that Heath Ledger's take on the character would be, and definitely not Joaquin Phoenix's masterful turn as the character as well. All other portrayals, in my opinion, of the Joker prior to this 89 version, they were basically stuck with the 66 Batman Clown Prince of Crime interpretation. It is very much Nicholson's fun, dark, and threatening version that is the breakthrough. Without this crucial bridge for the character, I doubt that the character would be such a daring and mesmerizing figure, and that the later portrayals of the Joker, I don't think we'd have them, and I don't think we'd have performances that were so great that they would put the Joker in contention with, like, you know, Hannibal Lecter from Silence of the Lambs as such a powerful, memorable, and important movie villain. So I can't state enough the importance of Nicholson's Batman, his performance in Batman as the Joker. It's so crucial. And you can tell he's having fun too. I mean, it shows a lot of fun to play this character. But as we said before, looking at The Man Who Laughs, you know, Tim Burton also, the way that he crafted this version of the Joker with Jack Nicholson, and the way that, whether Nicholson was aware of it or not, the way that they took elements from The Man Who Laughs and merge it into this version, so that it's not just a great version of the Joker from the comics, but it's also just a great version and interpretation, taking those various elements from The Man Who Laughs and kind of bringing them and reincorporating them into the character. It's just really interesting and just tremendous.
Man of San asks, how much of that version was due to Tim Burton? I think that's a good question, because I do think Tim Burton had a lot to do with this. And I think possibly the disfigurement, that might be because of Tim Burton's background and liking horror and all that kind of stuff and the sort of gothic thing. I think that might have been why. I don't know, but I think that might have been why we got the disfigurement. Is because he had seen the man who laughs. He knew the history of the character, and I highly suspect that's why he's disfigured.
No, yeah, I would be willing to like put money on the table that it's Tim Burton's influence that, like I said, that kind of brings elements from the man who laughs back to the Joker, because the 66 version, whatever was there that might have been in the original comics, it's gone. You know, by the time that Romero was done with it. And with the 89 Batman film, all those elements are brought back and kind of merged back with the Joker. And like I said, without this bridge, we would never get the later interpretations. So tell us again, I want to thank Dr. Hugo Strange for being on the show tonight. So tell us, Dr. Strange, how does this interpretation of the Joker for the 89 Batman film, how does this portrayal, is it close to your patient that you had at Arkham? Is this maybe one of the closer, or was your patient that you had at Arkham, was he very different from this version?
This one's very similar, actually. This is when he missed his medication. I'll never forget that day either. He left me a note saying, "Roses are red, violets are blue, dead robins are too." And not soon afterwards, there's a circus nearby and it exploded.
Wow. It's very dark. Very dark.
Very dark. Yeah. Very dark.
That's Joker. So, akin to Jack Nicholson, I mean, he had his theatrics down, his just maniacal way of thinking. I mean, he was there just pure anarchy, just there just to mess things up, but yet he was also very organized. He was a mastermind. He wanted to, you know, just take over the crime scene in Gotham. And this is a little bit more fresh in my mind since I actually got to see it at the Fathom events. Got to see it in theaters. I think it's my first time, actually. But he was downright terrifying, kind of like the Joker. I mean, you just never knew. I mean, him laughing, just like walking around, I mean, that was just kind of struck fear into me a little bit.
Interesting. So you'd say that this version is definitely much closer to your patient, the actual real Joker, than probably some of the other ones we've discussed so far.
Yes, due to, he had the chemical change. He's a murderous psychopath. And he has a big thing for the theatrics. So, I mean, it all makes sense. I mean, it's actually thinking about this, it's probably one of the most accurate versions we've had.
Interesting. So it looks like we do have another comment.
Yes, and I can say I remember reading about this, and Man of Sam says also around the same time was Frank Miller's comic. Did that possibly influence Tim Burton? Absolutely. I can answer that. That's 100% that Frank Miller's comic had a huge influence on the Tim Burton Batman. Huge, huge, huge.
Well, and Frank Miller's influence on all the various iterations of Batman looms incredibly large. Whether you're talking about Dark Knight Returns or you're talking about Batman Year One, it's definitely definitive for the character. Sometimes when people are interested in reading Batman comics, but they've never read a lot of comics, typically the two that I'll start them off with is, okay, well, here's Batman Year One, start with this. This is the beginning of Batman. Here's The Dark Knight Returns. This is how the story ends, in case you were curious. It's just, that just kind of, you know, and that material is so strong and so great.
Joker didn't see this coming in Dark Knight.
Yeah, that's true.
I will say, though, that one thing, and I can't find it. I have the graphic novel version of, I think it's like the first four or six, you know, Bob Kane Batman stories, like the very first, like four or five issues of Detective Comics before Batman spun off into his own series. I do recommend that one too. If you're someone who's not read Batman, start at the beginning, literally, because that stuff was pretty interesting. That's when Batman had a gun. Things like that.
Yeah. You know, so. And it's interesting too, because a lot of people you don't really think about how the various adaptations of the characters in the different media, like, you know, we don't really get Alfred in the context that we think of, you know, until later, and it
much
and
later, yeah, because yeah, Alfred, the original version of Alfred, he just showed up like after Batman's, you know, he wasn't like his father. He didn't serve the Waynes. He just showed up later and just was, you know, Bruce Wayne's butler, you know?
Yeah.
So they and I love Alfred. I think the interpretation of Alfred as like a surrogate father and stuff like that, I love that version, but that's not how Alfred started out.
And it's interesting that a lot of things that we think of as being classic to the characters, these always come later as other people add to it. It's the power of collaboration that eventually leads us, you know, to this place. And it's very interesting.
The other funny thing is, just a little bit of trivia there, is there's only one other character, you know, with Batman's family, if you will, Batman's big cast of characters. There's only one other character as old as Batman. There's only one. It's not Robin. Robin's not in the first appearance of Batman. It's not the Joker. He's not in the first appearance of Batman. The only one that is Commissioner Gordon. Commissioner Gordon is the same age as Batman. And I love Commissioner Gordon. So he was there from the beginning, though. So that's why Commissioner Gordon's so important, because he was there from the very beginning. Very first panel, I think. Even. So
tell us, Dr. Strange, you know, just out of curiosity, over the course of Batman's career, we've seen lots of different versions of the Joker, and we've seen lots of different iterations and versions of Commissioner Gordon. Has any one of those versions of Commissioner Gordon been closer to the actual police commissioner in Gotham City that you've actually worked with? Who was probably the closest?
Probably the one from the Nolan films.
So we're talking about the Gary Oldman, the actor Gary Oldman?
Yeah, it's Gary Oldman. It's definitely the closest one. Definitely not the one from the Burton films, and Gotham, we won't even speak of that show.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. We're very lucky to have Dr. Strange here actually fact-checking the realities of what it's actually like in Gotham City versus what sometimes we've seen in various media where we're talking about television shows or movies. Very cool.
Fake news, man. Fake news.
That's right. we're all about the real down and dirty about what's happening in Gotham City, not that fake news.
That's right. That's right.
Very cool. Is that good for 89? Does anyone else have anything they want to add?
Well, the thing for me with this version of the Joker is I remember that there were two things that stuck out. First of all, I already addressed the disfigurement issue, and I remember people kind of wigging out about that and being like, oh, that's not the comics, and, you know, find out later. Well, that predates the comics. It's actually the origin of the character. The other one is the controversial decision to have the Joker kill, Bruce Wayne's parents. A lot of people hated that, but that does absolutely influence Joaquin Phoenix's performance, because Joaquin Phoenix also indirectly killed Bruce Wayne's parents. So,
which I thought interesting. Was actually good.
So, but I think that's an interesting link between the Jack Nicholson Batman and the Joaquin Phoenix. The Jack Nicholson Joker and the Joaquin Phoenix Joker.
Yeah, it's an interesting. Interesting connection.
Yeah.
The thing that was really interesting for me personally, you know, prepping for this show and watching and preparing and getting all these notes together and everything, is just the interesting journey of the character, how it starts out, how it deviates, and how it comes back, you know, and how it kind of comes full circle. But how every person adds another little piece you know, eventually gets us, you know what I mean, to where we eventually wind up. But two of the best, you know, portrayals of the Joker in live action, in my opinion. I think, you know, that personally, our next episode, we're going to get into two of just the most mesmerizing, amazing interpretations of the Joker for me personally. They're just very, very, very interesting.
Yeah, I think in part two, we're gonna come across my personal definitive Joker. We'll do that in part two. He's gonna be one of our part two. And then also, you touched on this, Dave, but Man of San said Cesar Romero held a press conference during the 1989 movie release, complaining that its version of the Joker. That earlier when we were talking
well, about that. I hate to say this, Cesar Romero, but the Joker is violent.
That's true.
Yeah, Cesar Romero's Joker usually got beat up all the time. That's what, one thing I remember was he didn't do a lot of the beating on. He usually got beat up, you know. So
he is the high school bully Joker, like I said.
That's true. That's true. I did touch on that. Actually, the particular interview I referenced was actually CBS This Morning, and it's an older interview clip, and in it, Cesar Romero talks about the fact that reviewers were saying not to take your children to see the 89 film because of its violent content. And, you know, it's not just the violent content. I mean, there's a lot of dark humor and interesting choices they made, which makes the Joker more interesting, you know, as an older viewer. You know, let's say at least of a certain age, you know, to watch it. But along those same lines, too, maybe the 89 movie's tame now, you know, by today's standards. We talked about The Man Who Laughs at the beginning of all this from 1928. You know, they were concerned about the sexual boldness of that film. It's, and most of it's just this lady laying on a bed, she's fully clothed. I mean,
times wearing more have than changed.
They have. So,
and then Man of Sam said Cesar Romero was a villain in various Disney movies too, and he specifically mentions the computer wore tennis shoes. Are you familiar with that?
No,
I'm not familiar with that one. The computer wore tennis shoes. Yeah, I don't know that one. Unfortunately,
I don't know that one.
It must be Brainiac.
He says it was pretty campy as villains go, which I would assume.
Yes.
I mean, that
would make sense.
That's the portrayal that Cesar Romero did. I mean, it was campy. So.
Yeah. That's for sure. So is that good for our part one here, covering the Jokers?
Yeah, we just want to make sure that everybody knows we are doing a part two. So if we didn't cover, we're going in chronological order. So if we didn't cover your favorite Joker, because we didn't cover mine yet either, stay tuned, come back Wednesday, and we're going to get into all the other ones up to Joaquin Phoenix.
And we'll announce on the next episode, we'll announce the winner of the Joker sketch card. We'll have another sketch card, another prize giveaway for people participating in the chat on the next episode. So we'll announce the winner of this, and we'll also officially announce the winner of this here. This is some sample inks I did. This is the actual ink on board from Brightest Day. We'll announce the winner of this for those people who took the time to fill out the survey and help us by giving us some information to help us create a better show for you, our dear valued viewer and our dear valued listener. We'll be announcing both of those on the next episode as well. I think actually in a weird way, I think I know what you're going to say is your definitive version of the Joker, Eric. And it is definitive. While I like all these different interpretations of the Joker, I'm going to say Nicholson's probably mine. I just love
really?
The take on the Joker. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's just the whole way it's put together. I really like it. You know, I know some people take issue with the whole well, Joker didn't kill Batman's family. That was Joe Chill. It's like, yeah, yeah, I know that. But I just, I just really, really enjoyed Nicholson's take on the Joker. I always have. So,
oh, I do too. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely love his interpretation of the Joker, but he's not my definitive Joker. That's all I'm saying.
No, I understand. And I'm just saying he may not be, even in terms of the comics or whatever, he may not be the definitive Joker. You know, when you look at it and you look at the different portrayals and you look at the comics, like I'm those one of those weird nerdy people that considers the comics the source material and that we should, you know, pay sometimes more reverence to it than sometimes we do. But I'd have to say, I think Nicholson's Joker is for me is probably my favorite, my personal definitive Joker. I love the 89 film. I always have. And there's so much interesting stuff. And at the time in which Nicholson did this, it was so amazing because it broke so far from the campy interpretation from the 66 television series. And like I said, Romero's legacy looms so large because the influence of the 66 series, it carries over. And I mean, yeah, every absolutely. Version, because as a kid, you know, I still have it. I still have my old Power Record, you know, Batman stories. I still have a lot of that material. I still have the Fisher Price, the Laughing Sphinx, you know, story with the cassette tape and the book, and you flip through the page. It's like, I still have all those things. I kept them because I've loved them since I was a child. But all those interpretations of the Joker, regardless of who did it, it's all Romero. It's all Cesar Romero, you know, carrying all the way through to the cartoons. We don't get a radical departure until Nicholson. And it's with what Nicholson does, his ideas and Tim Burton's ideas, it is that really gives us the opportunity to eventually have the amazing performances from, you know, people such as, you know, Heath Ledger and Joaquin Phoenix. I mean, just without him to bridge the gap, I don't know if they would have taken it as far. I think someone might have taken it as far as Nicholson did, but I don't know if they would have taken it as far. Wow, you aren't kidding, Dr. Strange. Yeah. You do have therapy cats in there.
I do.
And Man of Sand seems to agree with you because he says Nicholson certainly was a standout landmark Joker.
I would definitely agree with that assessment.
And also, PJ mentioned with your art earlier. That's beautiful, Dave, in terms of the art you were showing earlier.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. The whole point is just to encourage people to be part of what we're doing here. But I do appreciate the comment. Thank you very much.
We want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Retro Rogues Live podcast. You can learn more about Eric Alexander and Find the Live Show on either Twitch, YouTube, or Twitter by searching for BassGod14, that's BASSGOD14, on either YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter. If you are curious about co-host Dave Beatty, you can see some of his art, find social media links, and so much more at his website, DaveBeatty.com. That's DaveBeatty.com. If you enjoyed this episode of the Retro Rogues Live, be sure to like, share, and subscribe.